you would be finding the book of John in your Bibles, our lesson today will come from the book of John. Last week we started looking at the most important claim in the Bible, and that is that Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the Christ, the promised one, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, is also, and most importantly, the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God. How important is that statement that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? It's what separates Christianity from every other religion in the entire world. There are other religions who would claim to worship the same God, even. For instance, Judaism claims to worship the same God. The Muslims would say they worship the same God. They believe in one creator of all the world. And the Muslims would even say they believe in Abraham and David. And they would say they believe in Jesus. But what they would say about Jesus is that he was a prophet. Just like prophets in the Old Testament and just like Muhammad. That he was a man that God spoke through. But they would tell you, if you ask them, yes, we believe in Jesus too. But they don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God. In fact, their book, the Quran, says it is wrong to say that God has a son. Now, as far as the Jews go, I don't really know what many of them today. It'd be interesting if you had some Jewish friends. I imagine you'd get all different kinds of answers if you ask them, what do you believe about Jesus? I would suspect that many of them would say that he was a wise teacher. They may even say he was a rabbi in his day, that he was a traveling wise man who had many good things to say. And for most of the world who don't deny that there ever was such a person, and I don't think very many people even do, I don't know if, I've never met anybody that would say there was never anybody who ever even lived, named Jesus. I mean, most people agree there was somebody named Jesus, but they would probably say he was a wise man, he was a good teacher, he said a lot of good things. And even some non-believers would say, there's a lot of good stuff in the Bible, especially when you read what Jesus taught. There's some good wisdom there about how we should live and treat other people, and all that's good stuff. But if you were to say, but is he the Son of God? They would say, no, I don't think so, if they're not a believer. So the fact that Jesus is the Son of God is what the whole thing turns on. And it is what separates Christianity apart from any other religion. Now, notice what is said in John chapter 3, verse 16 beginning. This is what many people would say is the most famous, most well-known verse in the whole Bible. There's a bunch of verses in the Bible, but most people would say that John 3:16 is the most best-known verse in the Bible. And I think that's probably true. It begins, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life." Let's keep on reading. "For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God." So the Bible just stakes a claim and puts it right there and says, this is it. You're either on this side or you're on that side. There is one Son of God. His name is Jesus. This is the claims of the Bible, the claims of the New Testament. And those who believe in Jesus as the Son of God have eternal life and they're not condemned. Those who do not believe in the name of the Son of God, who do not believe in Jesus, are condemned. And that's what the Bible says about it. It's just that simple. That it's a dividing point for people of all times. And that is this question of, who is Jesus? Is he the Son of God? Well, so last week we were asking the question, why should anybody believe that Jesus is the Son of God? That's an amazing claim. That there was a person who lived and he looked like everybody else and he seemed like everybody else, but in fact he was different than every other person who's ever walked on the planet. And you say, well, why would I believe that? Why should anybody believe that there was such a person who lived a long time ago on the other side of the world and they were different than everybody else? Well, there's several reasons why we should believe. There's several types of evidence that we can introduce. And you, again, thinking of a courtroom, if you have you're trying to decide, the facts of a case or the truthfulness of something, and people would submit evidence to support this argument or this claim or this, you know, the innocence or guilt of something, and they're saying, here's the evidence, and they call witness after witness to share their view. And then as the jury, they sit and they take all this in, they have to make up their mind. What do they believe about it? Well, last week, the evidence that we considered was really the evidence of the prophet Isaiah, and we talked about prophecies and how there were things written, and we know they were written hundreds and hundreds of years before Jesus that were fulfilled in him. And that forms a very powerful kind of evidence that Jesus is the Son of God. As Isaiah said, the virgin will conceive and bear a child. And Isaiah said, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. He will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And there were many other that we didn't even get into. And so it's as if Isaiah has been on the stand and we now say, thank you very much, Isaiah. We're going to call another witness. And so in today's lesson, we're going to be looking at signs and wonders. In other words, the miracles of Jesus. So yet, last week, we looked at prophecies, and that's a very powerful evidence that Jesus is the Son of God, the fulfillment of prophecies that we know were written before he was alive. Today, we're looking at another evidence that he was the Son of God, and it is the miracles, the signs and wonders that he performed. So we're going to be looking at some examples of those. And we might also ask the question as we get started, why should I believe that Jesus did miracles, right? So, of course, you can say there was a man a long time ago and he did some amazing things, but why should anybody believe that? Why should somebody today in our scientific, enlightened, you know, modern country, culture, believe that those things happened? Well, here's the evidence. We have, in the New Testament, handwritten documents that were eyewitness testimony that are submitted as evidence. And this is probably a good time to point out that the Bible, as we look at it, if you just flip through it, it all looks the same in English. And, you know, from the oldest book all the way up to the very end of it, it's all the same font, it's all the same size, and it just looks like one big book. But of course, it's not. It's lots of books written by different authors. And if we had photocopied, copies of these letters, it would be fascinating, wouldn't it? But if you had photocopies of the originals all bound together, you would see different handwriting, you would see different languages, different alphabets even, as you skim from one part to the next. Probably some of them had neat handwriting, some of them had horrible handwriting, and we know Paul employed some other people to write his letters for him, but it would be cool, wouldn't it, if you had a photocopy of the originals. What you would really see is that this is a library of books and letters and different type histories and poems and all kinds of documents that have been bound together over a long period of time. And that's what we call the Bible. And today we're looking at this gospel, the good news, a biography about Jesus written by John, who was one of his disciples who walked with him and sat with him and ate with him and was there to see these things. And so John has written down some things for us. In fact, skip over to near the end of the book, chapter 20. And look at what John says in John chapter 20. In verse 30, John says, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, including himself, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that by believing you may have life in his name. So in chapter 3, John says the whole world is divided into two groups. Those who believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and have life in his name, and those who don't. And in chapter 20, he says, I've written these things down so that you... Now, who is the you? That's the reader. So as you read this letter, you become the you. I don't think John knew who he wasn't writing to a specific you. He was writing to anybody who would read this. And anybody who reads what he wrote can see his evidence that he's putting forward, his testimony, his story of his time with Jesus and what he saw. And he's sort of like being called to the witness stand. And we're going to let John tell us, John, start from the beginning and tell us, what did you see? And so John, in his book, tells us what Jesus taught, the things he did, what happened to him, the people he interacted with. And along the way, he tells us many signs. Now, John uses this word sign, which is interesting. We think of miracle and wonder would be just something where you say, wow, I'm blown away by that, right? But a sign includes a different idea. What does a sign do? It communicates, doesn't it? A sign tells you something. It might just be an arrow, but even the arrow is telling you something, isn't it? Or the sign might have a message, or it might be a symbol that means warning or danger, but all signs have a meaning. And what John is saying, I believe, is that these miracles weren't just something to say, wow, but they had a meaning. There was a point to it all. They were pointing, they were telling us something. And so Jesus, John says, did a lot of signs, but I'm writing these so that you may believe, so that we could share in his faith. And so John, in his gospel, selected certain things to write about. And in fact, some people have noticed and pointed out that if you were to go through and look at the signs, there are 7 signs that John chose to write about and to tell us about. And so what we're going to do this morning, because as you can see, that's a lot. I usually have 3 points. That's 7. So we'll take a break for lunch around here. No, we're going to go fast. And I kind of hate to do that because you could easily preach all day about some of these. But we're just going to do an overview of the 7 signs that John chose to put in his gospel so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So John's saying, I've written about these, obviously with the inspiration of the Spirit. I've written about these things and I'm sharing them with you so that you can believe and have life in Jesus. The first one is in chapter 2, right off the bat. In chapter 2, it's an interesting miracle, kind of an unusual miracle. It happens at a wedding. Jesus was invited to a wedding, and his disciples were there. And that's not something we normally think about. Here's Jesus and his disciples, and somebody says, hey, who do you want to put on the list? Hey, let's invite Jesus and his people, his followers, to come. We want them at the wedding. So maybe there was some connection. His mother is there, and she's serving, so it might have been somehow related, some connection to their family. But verse 1 and 2 tells Jesus and his disciples were invited to a wedding, and then there was a problem. Verse 3 says the wine ran out, and the mother of Jesus said, they have no wine. Now, you've probably experienced this yourself. If you haven't, you've probably been somewhere where it happened, where you have people coming and you run out of something. It's a horrible feeling. I was thinking about when that's happened to us, and when we were invited maybe a year or two ago to some friends of ours were putting on with a luau. And they had a roasted pig and did it Hawaiian style. But they invited us, and they invited a bunch of people, and they said, be here at a certain time. We let them know we're going to be a little late. I think we had a soccer game or something we had to do, and we're going to come. We'll be a little bit late. They said, no problem. Come on. When we got there, the food was gone. I mean, we brought a dish, and it was like the place was wiped out. There was no pig left, and Sarah was heartbroken about that. And there was the people felt bad, like the food was gone. They ran out and here's guests and they didn't have, we had to eat like the potato salad nobody liked or whatever that was still there. And, plus whatever we brought. But, it's embarrassing when you have people over and you run out of something, whether it's the ice or the drinks or the food. And here they've run out of the wine. And so they come to Jesus. Now the next couple of verses, he says, this isn't really my problem or concern. And that's true. I mean, Jesus he wasn't around to take care of making sure parties had what they needed, but he decides to use the occasion to show his glory. And that's what happens next. Beginning in verse 6, it says there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. That statement's loaded with meaning. We're going to have to skip over it and keep going. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water, and they filled them up to the brim, and he said to them, now draw some out. So these are jars full of water. Draw some out, take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine, and he didn't know where it came from, although the servants who drew the water knew, they came from the well. The master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and then when people have drunk freely the poor wine, but you've kept the good wine until now. So these water pots had been filled up to the top with water. They took some out. They took it to the master of the feast. He said, wow, I'm used to this being served first, but you've kept the best stuff till the last. This is amazing. And what was the impact that this had on those who did know? Verse 11 says, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did in Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. He did the sign, and those who were his disciples saw it, and it increased their faith. They believed. It was telling them something, and they believed. Okay, we got to move along. In chapter 4, we come to the next one. John, of course, writes about other things. It's not just a book of signs. So he tells us some, people Jesus talked to and some things he taught. But we're just looking at signs today. At the end of chapter 4, Well, verse 7 says that, that's 47, yeah, sorry. Down near the end of chapter 4, there's an official, and this official's son is sick. His son is very, very sick, in fact. Verse 47 said, when this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Thankfully, I've never experienced that. What a horrible thing. Even just this past New Year's Day, Grant was sick, and he stayed in bed all day long, which he doesn't ever do. And it's a horrible feeling, even though we knew he'd get better, because it's just one of those things you have to work through. But you hate it as a parent to have a child who's sick, and you feel helpless. Because you can't, and even today, nearly 2,000 years later, with all of our medical advancements, there's children who get sick, and with all of our technology and all that, there's times when the doctors say there's nothing we can do. Or they try what they can do and it doesn't work. And so we still feel helpless in the face of many diseases and illnesses. And here's this man, his son is nearly about to die, and he hears that Jesus has come, and he says, Jesus, can you come please do something about this? Verse 50, Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus had spoken to him and went on his way. He was expecting Jesus to come back with him, but he believed Jesus and he left without him. As he was going, verse 51, his servants met him. They must have been really excited. And they told him his son was recovering. And he asked them the hour he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. And the father knew that that was the hour that Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he himself believed in all his household. Notice the point. There were signs. When people saw the signs, they believed. Now we'll look later. Did everybody believe? And the answer is no. We'll see that as we get further down. But he saw the sign. He believed. What was the sign? He found out. He was a long ways away. It wasn't until the next day that he got near home and his servants came and met him. And they said yesterday at a certain time, the seventh hour, his fever went away. And the man knew that was the exact moment that Jesus had said to him, go, your son will live. So there's two things that are amazing about this miracle or sign. Number one, Jesus, the creator, has the power over disease, of course. And if you think back to where we started with the whole thing in creation and sin and the curses and death and all the bad stuff that came as a result of that, and the fact that somebody was going to come and fix it, Jesus had the power as the one through whom all things were created to undo the damage of disease, to fix things, to heal people, to correct things back to the way they should be. And so that's, you know, the first thing that we notice about this. But the second thing that perhaps is maybe even more amazing to me is that he could do it from way far away. Having never seen or met the boy, to our knowledge, how would you do that? We don't know. I mean, if somebody tells you, I'd like you to, you know, pray for my niece and her friend and, you know, and you've never met them, you can pray for them, but you've never seen them before. You don't know who they are. They're somewhere else. But Jesus had the ability from over here to touch and heal somebody far away. That's pretty amazing. Only the Son of God could do something like that. And the verse 53, of course, said that the Father and his household, when they figured this out, they believed. All right, moving along, chapter 5. In the next chapter, Jesus goes down to Jerusalem. Instead of a child with an illness, a life-threatening illness, this is an older man with a chronic, lifelong disability. He lives in Jerusalem, and he is laying at a pool called Bethesda with a bunch of other sick people. And we're told in verse 5, the man who had been there had been an invalid. In other words, he'd been disabled for 38 years. I don't know if that means his whole life or if he had been injured at some point and then 38 years. But anyway, for 38 years, he's been unable to take care of himself or provide for himself. He depended on other people to move him around and do things for him. So he's been laying there, and Jesus asked him a very interesting question in verse 6. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he'd been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be healed? Again, we could talk about that a lot. Do you want to be healed? I think sometimes, you know, we could ask somebody who's got any number of problems, do you want to be healed? Do you want to get, if you have a sin problem, do you want to be cured of this? Do you want to be better? Because sometimes people don't really want to be better, right? But this man, he wanted to be better, and he explained he wanted to be healed, but he had nobody to help him into the water. And in verse 8, Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now what's interesting about that is we're now in the capital city of Jerusalem. This man laid in this very public pool. He laid beside it. He had been an invalid for 38 years, and he had been laying there for a long time. What does all that mean? This was a very populous place, and this would have been a well-known man, I'm sure, to anybody that was around there. It'd be like if you went uptown, you know, to the square, only in a much larger city, but, and there was always somebody who was always laying there who was, you know, and we even have people around here who have, you know, you see them out and about, and kind of everybody knows who they are, and they have some kind of problem or some kind of disability, but, you know, you just recognize them because they're just sort of a well-known person in town because you see them all the time. And I'm sure this was the same kind of thing with this guy. And now what's he doing? He's up walking around. He's fine. And so this would have been a very public, not something that happened kind of out in the countryside where there was rumors of it or people word kind of spread around. But this is right there in the middle of the capital city and a very well-known man, I'm sure, who'd been there for a long time who's now suddenly well. There's no way to deny that miracle. Now we look at the next chapter. A different kind of miracle completely. And that's one thing that's kind of neat about these. They weren't like all the same sort of, you know, thing where you could sort of start to say, yeah, maybe there's like a trick to this. But it's like all kinds of different things that Jesus did and could do. And in chapter 6, he goes from being right in the middle of the capital city. He's out in back in Galilee up in the north. And he goes up onto a mountain and there's a huge crowd and they follow him out there. And why is the crowd following him, by the way? Verse 2 says, they saw the signs. So people are seeing the signs. They're seeing what he's doing with the sick people. They're seeing these healing them, and they're following him. And the same thing would happen today. You can believe it. If somebody started doing these things, pretty soon they'd be filling stadiums with people wanting to see what they're going to do. So that's what Jesus is doing. And they're not necessarily believers yet, but they've seen the signs, and they want to know more. And so there's this big crowd. They go out there, and Jesus asks a trick question to one of his own disciples. He says to Philip, verse 5, lifting up his eyes then, seeing a large crowd that was coming, he said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. It's kind of funny to me. But so they're way out, they're on a mountain, they're in the middle of nowhere, and there's thousands of people, and Jesus says to Philip, "So where are we going to buy lunch for the crowd?" You know, I mean, first of all, there's probably nobody that would sell that much food anyway, anywhere. And secondly, they're out in the middle of nowhere. And thirdly, Philip immediately thinks of the cost. He says, 200 denarii, nearly, you know, better part of a year's wages, wouldn't even buy enough bread for everybody to have a taste of it. And here they are. Jesus and his disciples are not wealthy people. And Jesus is proposing to Philip that they provide lunch for the people who've showed up for the day. And Philip says, this is crazy. But Jesus is just doing it to test him, you know, just to, because Jesus already knew what he had in mind. And so Andrew, interestingly, in verse 8, says, in verse 9, there's a boy here who has 5 loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many people? Jesus said, well, have everybody sit down. And there was much grass in the place, so they all sat down, 5,000 people in number. And Jesus then, the men sat down, sorry, about 5,000 in number. That may be even twice that many if you count women, and maybe even more if there were children. But they all sat down. He took the loaves. So we have 5 loaves and 2 fish. He took those loaves of bread and he distributed them. He prayed for them and gave thanks, of course, in verse 11, first of all. And then he distributed them. So they ate the fish as much as they wanted. When they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples to go around and pick up the leftovers. And they gathered up 12 baskets of leftovers. So the little boy had brought his lunch, probably rolled up in a sack or something or a bag. And it was 5 loaves of bread, probably not big loaves anyway, because it was a meal for a child, and 2 fish, probably dried fish or something like that. It's pretty common. And Jesus said, just start passing them around. And this huge crowd, when they got done, they were gathering up. You got any leftovers? 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 And they had 12 baskets full of leftovers that were all started from the 5 loaves and 2 fish. And that was after everybody had eaten as much as they wanted. And of course, this is a marvelous sign. And notice what the people said in verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Now we're connecting two ideas. They were connecting two ideas. First one is, they saw the signs. Second one is, they thought of prophecies. There was a promise that a prophet like me, Moses said, would come. And they said, "This is him. He's the one we're waiting on." They saw the sign. They thought of the prophecies. They put the two together and they said, "This is the one." And so that's the same kind of thought process that I'm suggesting for us today. Now next, later that same evening, same chapter, Jesus did probably one of his best known miracles. In fact, if you were just to ask somebody on the street, name a miracle of Jesus, probably walking on water would be the one that would come to most people's minds. It's just somehow, I don't know why, of all the things he did, it captures the imagination. And so this particular one is one that's well known. It's recorded in several other gospel accounts. Of course, John is one of four gospels who have told the story of Jesus. And this particular miracle shows up in some of the others, and maybe all four of them. I can't think of it at the moment. But in John's account here, Jesus has fed the thousands. He's told his disciples to go down and go ahead and cross over the Sea of Galilee. In verse 16, they went down and went into the sea. They got into a boat and they started across the sea to Capernaum. It was dark. Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. They had rowed about 3 or 4 miles. They saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." They're 3 or 4 miles from shore. The Sea of Galilee is about 8 miles across. Of course, it's not, you know, it depends on where you are, but about 8 miles wide. And so they're somewhere near the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and they're rowing, and it's at night, and it's rocking and waving and windy, and they're having a hard time going. And meanwhile, while they're just struggling to get this boat across, here comes Jesus walking along on top of the water. And they're immediately frightened. They don't understand. And Jesus says, "Don't be afraid. It is me." What an amazing thing. And it's no wonder this miracle sort of captures our imaginations. And what does this say about the power of Jesus or about what he could do? Well, as the one through whom the world was created, as the Son of God, he had power over the laws of physics as we think about it. Now, we know physically there's reasons why you can't walk on the water unless it happens to be pretty cold outside, in which case it's not that much of a miracle to walk on the water. But as long as it's, you know, above freezing, there's reasons why you can't walk on water physically. But those laws of physics that govern how we, you know, interact with the rest of the world are all set in motion by the Creator, and he can change them and modify them. And if he wanted everybody to be able to walk on water, he could do that. We just can't, because that's the rules we live by. And he made the rules, and he could override them. And that's what he was doing. So he's walking along on the water. And it's interesting little detail in the next verse that's often overlooked. Verse 21 says, they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. So again, if we're at the part where it's 8 miles wide, they're somewhere near the middle, beaten by the winds and waves. They're excited when they realize, oh, it's Jesus, and they're glad. They get him in the boat, and poof, they're on the other side. I don't even know if they realized it at that time. You wonder if they, wow, this is amazing. So again, Jesus, you know, another part of the sign. Now, could Jesus have just had them instantly be on the other side to begin with and skipped all the difficulty of rowing in the middle of the night? Yes. What point can we draw from that? Does Jesus sometimes let us face difficulties and hardships? And yes, he does. Does he allow sickness to exist? Yes, and we're going to get to it in the next one. But he can use those things to accomplish his purpose. And that's what he did in the middle of the night. That's what happens in the next one. Now we have to skip over a few chapters to chapter 9 for the next miracle. The scene opens with an important question. Chapter 9, verse 1. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And the disciples said, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" So they bought into a very common philosophy that bad things happen for a reason. It's sort of like karma, is another way of putting it, or, you know, different things where it basically says, if you do good, good things happen. If you do bad, bad things happen. So if bad things happen, somebody did something bad. So here's a man who's born blind, and now they're wondering, okay, he was born blind. Was this a punishment because of something his mom and dad did, because it happened when he was born? Or is it somehow related to something that he did? So who is at fault that caused him to be born blind? Who is the one who did something wrong that made this man be this way? And that's a pretty common, even today, view that people have that, well, something horrible happened. This is somehow punishment, you know. And it was all the way back to Job. His friend said, Job, you did something terrible. Whatever you did, it must have been awful because look at what's happening to you. And even today, if something, you see somebody and they calamity falls on, people sometimes get a little suspicious, like, maybe they had it coming. Maybe they did something wrong or they weren't, you know. Not always, but we tend to think that way. And that's what his disciples do. Jesus says in verse 3, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. So this is a very difficult thing to accept. But over and over in scriptures, we see that God allowed people to suffer and he had a purpose in mind for that. And he could use even the worst of suffering in a way to bring glory to himself. And that's what's going to happen here. Verse 6, having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. And then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. And he went and washed and came back seeing. Interesting little detail. In Genesis 2, it says, and the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground. Isn't that neat? So Jesus gets a little of that stuff that we're made out of, works it up and fixes the problem. Tells him to go wash and his eyes, and now he can see. Of course, that wouldn't work for anybody else if we were to try that, but it works for the Son of God. And it was such an amazing miracle that the people that the man went to and said, hey, I can see now. I need to, you know, present an offering or do what I need to do. And they didn't believe that he had been blind until they called for his parents. And they said, is this your son? And was he born blind? And they said, yep. But look at what the blind man says in verse 32. The blind man himself says, never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. So maybe if somebody had some kind of eye problem that they developed over time, you could cure them somehow. But if somebody's born blind, there was no, at least in this guy's experience, there was no record of anybody ever being healed who had been born blind, and yet this man was born blind. Now, did everybody believe? No. They threw him out. Verse 35 says, Jesus heard they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said, you've both seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. Over and over and over and over and over and over and over in John, Jesus did a sign, people believed. And that's what John tells us in chapter 20. These are written, so you may believe. All right, one more to go. Chapter 11. This one's a doozy. Lots to say about Lazarus. We're just not going to have time to dive into it. But we'll summarize the point. Because have you noticed these seem to kind of build in intensity? Isn't that kind of neat? Water to wine, all the way down. Nobody's ever heard of a man being born blind. And now we've got one better than that. So at the beginning of the chapter, Mary and Martha and Lazarus, good friends of Jesus. Lazarus is sick. Mary and Martha send to tell Jesus, he whom you love is ill. He's sick. They let him know. Jesus says, this sickness isn't going to lead to death. It's going to lead to, you know, God being glorified. And then he waits a couple of days. And while he's waiting, Lazarus has died. And Jesus tells his disciples, Lazarus is dead. We're going to go see him. And so they go down there. And when they arrive, Lazarus has been dead. He's been buried in the tomb for 4 days by the time Jesus shows up, but people are still together and they're still mourning. And Martha comes out to meet Jesus. And she says when she comes out to see him, if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. But he's dead. Jesus didn't answer the call. Even though Jesus had the ability to heal from 1,000 miles away, and he could have healed him a minute, and he could have healed him before they even told him. But they had sent message to him and he didn't heal him. He allowed him to die. But notice what happens. Verse 23, Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? John, over and over and over, brings us to that question. That's the question of the whole book. do you believe this? He said in chapter 1, everyone who believed in his name, he gave the right to become sons of God. All the way down to the last closing words, he's saying, these things are written that you may believe. Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me and dies will live again, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? He's talking about eternal life. Notice her question, her answer. Verse 27, she said, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God who is coming into the world. That's it. That's what John's talking about. That's the saving faith. That's the answer. That's what brings eternal life. And so Jesus accompanies her to the tomb. Lazarus is still dead. The people come. Jesus is deeply moved. He weeps when he sees everyone else and their grief. But verse 38 says, then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And he said, take away the stone. And Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he's been dead 4 days. You don't want to go in there. You know, sometimes people came to anoint bodies or to do things. He's been dead for 4 days. You don't want to go in there. You don't want to roll that rock back. And Jesus said to her in verse 40, did I not tell you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes, and he said, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. And when he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! And the man who had died came out with his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said, unbind him and let him go. What's the point? The Son of God has power over the tomb. And when he says, come out, you're coming out. And he can say that to Lazarus. And he says elsewhere, he's going to say that one day, and everybody's tomb's going to be open and everybody's coming out. Those who are alive are going to remain alive forever. Those who've died are going to come back to life, and then there's going to be a judgment day. But the fact that he has the power to do that is proved right here. Now you would think surely everybody around believed in him because he could call a dead man out of the tomb. But no. Verse 45 says, many of the Jews therefore believed. But verse 46 said, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. The chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. Well, what are you to do? That's the question of the book. He did many signs. They didn't deny it. They couldn't deny it. They didn't know what to do. The only thing to do is to believe in him. But that was always a choice. It was a choice from the very first sign all the way down to the last sign. No matter what Jesus did, people had a choice to believe in him or not believe in him. Some people chose to believe in him. Some people chose not to believe in him. These people chose not to believe. In fact, they chose to reject him, and they chose to ultimately to kill him. But John, of course, says, these things are written that you may believe, so you can decide to follow the Son of God. So here's the seven signs that John includes, not including the numero uno big one, which is his resurrection from the dead, which we'll get to later. But the seven signs that Jesus did during his ministry that John chose to write about, and he said there's a whole bunch more. In fact, if we tried to write them all down, it would be too big of a book. And so here's seven of them, and he said, I wrote these down through the Spirit so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, Son of God, and have life in his name. Isn't that a wonderful thing? This morning, we have to decide, what do we believe about Jesus? As we learn more and more about him, and we'll continue calling witnesses to the stand to make our case that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and Lord willing, we'll continue that next week. But today, if you know that you believe and you haven't yet confessed that belief and you haven't submitted your life and given your life to him to become a disciple, and if there's anything that we can do to help you do that, we'd be glad to help you this morning if you'll let us know while we stand and sing.